Welcome to a new Unburied Books mini-series where we discuss not people republishing books, but bringing new voices in. So we're going to be talking to some small presses, fiction, nonfiction, translation, and today we're starting off with $2 Radio.
Eric Obanov is joining us, and I think it was a very enlightening conversation because of how candid he was about the struggles that he's faced over the years and also what really drives him, what they're passionate about over there. And I think it's great that we have this new little format where we can talk about new books that might be forgotten, might never have been published.
Yeah.
If it weren't for presses like $2 Radio, when we spend so much time talking about older books, classic books that are themselves underappreciated.
Yeah, we need to appreciate all books from all sides.
Here's that conversation.
Well, welcome, Eric. It's a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, just to start out, we wanted to know about just your background as a reader.
As a reader?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think I was kind of a late bloomer in terms of like just falling in love with books. That didn't really happen until I was in college. And then I just, you know, became just gobbled up any kind of book I could get my hands on. And then it was just like a whole new world had opened to me. And so I started out originally with a lot of the classics. And then I found that a lot of the books that I was gravitating towards were being published by small presses, indie presses. And so then I realized at a certain point, I should also say I was going to school. Eliza, my partner who started $2 Radio with me, we met when we were going to NYU. And my favorite bookstore at the time was St. Mark's Bookshop, which is unfortunately no longer there. But it was a great place to just disappear and find a bunch of like rowdy, independently published books that you wouldn't necessarily find at, you know, Barnes & Noble or, you know, some of the more run-of-the-mill bookshops. So that was really exciting for me. And then a few years in, I realized that I was going to bookstores with the intention of just like poking around and trying to find the little colophones or logos of indie presses as opposed to authors that I'd read before. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of eye-opening to me. And then I ended up picking up a book by Andre Schifrin, who had been publisher at Pantheon for a bunch of years. And that book was called The Business of Books. The subtitle is How International Corporations Took Over Publishing and Changed the Way We Read. And then that sort of led to us wanting to start our own press. Mm-hmm. So we started it really young. I think I was only like 23, mm-hmm. 24 at the time. And so it was good and bad because I do feel like I missed out on a lot of just like that leisurely educational reading that can come about during that time and just immediately jumped into editing manuscripts and things like that.
Hey, but you created something really cool.
Yeah, it's a pretty good alternative.
Yeah. And what was the idea behind $2 Radio? Like, how did it get started? Why did you want to do it? Things like that.
Well, I think that we were really naive and idealistic and just, you know, young enough to think that you can do anything, I guess. I don't know. And so we came at it, even though we didn't have any money. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we came at it idealistically as opposed to, you know, with more like realistic expectations as to like what actually goes into the day-to-day process. I feel like I've said it before, like at the time I didn't know what a barcode was. And so just like, you know, being really transparent with printers and different people in the industry and being like, what's a barcode? Where do I get a barcode? And people were very patient with us as we were starting out. And I'm grateful for that. I guess that the reason why we wanted to start was because it just felt like a lot of the books that I was drawn to a certain type of like bold literary work that I felt like was getting harder and harder to find. And so that was really the seed of inspiration for wanting to start the press. But in addition to reading Andre Schifrin's book, I also picked up this old copy of Punk Planet, which was this really incredible kind of like community in a magazine that was published out of Chicago. And I subscribed to it, but they were doing this like backlist sale on older issues. And so I looked on it and I was like, oh man, they have this issue called The Revenge of Print. That's something I'm really interested in. And so I ordered this back issue. And in there was an article by Johnny Temple, who's the publisher at Akashic Books. And he basically just like included his email address in there. And the essay that he wrote was saying like, you know, publishing has become more approachable than ever because of different tech advances, and you can essentially do it from your laptop. And as a publisher, you always receive more quality manuscripts than you could ever possibly publish. Mm-hmm. And so that was why he put his email in there. He's like, if you're thinking about starting a press, drop me a line. And the article that had originally been published like 2 years before, but I reached out to him and I was like, we want to do this. If there's anything that you think is really good that you aren't able to publish for one reason or another, let me know. And that was how we originally got in touch with Rudolf Wurlitzer. Dennis Cooper had an imprint at Akashic called Little House in the Bowery, and he was doing a lot of like edgy, cutting edge things, but he wanted to focus on debut writers. And Wurlitzer he hadn't published a novel in a quarter century. And so the publishing industry just has such like a short attention span.
Yeah.
And so for them, that meant he had no like sales history track record. But, you know, he published his first three novels, Nog, then Flats, and then Quake, in the late 60s, early 70s, all with, I think, like Penguin or Random House and Dutton. Mm-hmm. And, but, you know, he was also like writing, and then he got really entrenched in Hollywood and wrote a bunch of movies for like Sam Peckinpah and different people. So he's just like this real like countercultural iconic figure who I adored. I still adore. He's amazing. But he was someone that, you know, for whatever reason, he was willing to like hear us out, even though we didn't have a distributor at the time. And like, I have told this story before, but it's like amazing. I first met him, we were living in Brooklyn at the time. And he's like, I'm going to go visit a friend in the city. He lived further upstate at the time. And he's like, I'm going to go visit a friend. Let's get together and we can just meet at my friend's house. And I was like, all right, cool. And so I show up and I'm like 24, 25. And his friend is Philip Glass. And so like we were in like Philip Glass's like townhouse basement. And the whole time he's playing the piano in like the room above us. And I just like couldn't believe my good fortune. Mm-hmm. And then like, so we had this great talk. There was immediately like an affinity there with Rudy, who I just like greatly respected. And then the next day, mind blowing the timing, we actually got a letter that we were accepted for distribution. So I called him and I was like, Rudy, we just got a distributor. And he's like, oh, that's great news. I was actually just hanging out here with Bob Downey. And so it's like Robert Downey Sr. and stuff like that. And he's like, I was just telling about you guys and all this stuff. So that was, I guess, how we started out. But the focus has always been to publish books that we do get a lot of really quality submissions that could also be published by big publishers. But I don't think it benefits a small press to function just like, to publish a book that could be published by anyone else. So we've tried to be really deliberate in terms of what we take on in hoping that it fills some kind of need or space in the reading landscape.
Gotcha. Interesting. Could you tell us a little bit more about specifically what those books are to you that $2 Radio puts out that maybe nobody else would?
Well, there's a book called The Orange Eats Creeps by Grace Krilanovich. And we originally published that in 2010. and we're reissuing it as part of this new series that we're calling the New Classics, the $2 Radio New Classics. And so these are some of the evergreen titles that are evergreen backlist titles that we're like reapproaching with new introductions or afterwards from other writers. And the way that I heard about, we've always accepted unsolicited submissions, and Grace submitted her manuscript to us. Steve Erickson, a writer I was always really fond of, we were corresponding. I think they were having me out to do like a panel at CalArts at the time, and he's like, a former student of mine just submitted a manuscript to her, and it's like brilliant and mind-blowing and all this stuff. And I was like, well, if Steve Erickson says it's like brilliant and mind-blowing and everything, I'll check it out. And it was like the most like nervy language I'd encountered maybe ever. I mean, she was compared to Kathy Acker and William Burroughs because she used cut-ups, Grace did. But she wrote the book while she was still in the MFA program at CalArts. Mm-hmm. And the original prompt was just like draw 5 themes out of a hat and then write a story along those lines, that around those themes. And those were slutty teenage hobo vampire junkies. And she just like blew it apart. So it's about this young teenage runaway who's searching for her disappeared foster sister along the highway that eats people. I think some other like comparable pop culture references, you know, might be like Charles Burns' Black Hole. Mm-hmm. And then also, I didn't find this out until a couple years afterwards, but Grace grew up in Santa Cruz, and they were filming, when she was a child, they were filming that movie, the 80s movie, The Lost Boys, there.
Mm-hmm.
You know that movie?
Yeah, isn't that the Schumacher movie?
I don't know who the director was, okay. But it was starring, I think, like Kiefer Sutherland. Yes. And they're, yes, like vampires.
I've never seen it, but I have heard of it.
Yeah, but all of a sudden it like kind of like it helped me understand, I guess, where Grace was coming from.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense where there's, you know, the story takes place during this period where there's all these like serial killers, you know, in the Northwest, like stalking the highways and everything. But it is a pretty acerbic, edgy book. You know, it ended up getting, you know, it was one of NPR's best books of the year. The National Book Foundation spotlighted it as one of their like 5 under 35 for that year. At the time when I took it on, it was like the lowest advance that we'd offered a writer. Just, I was like kind of terrified that we'd even break even on it. But it was just one of those books where it's like the Field of Dreams principle. It's like so singular and distinctive, and people were hungry for that. And it just became, if you look at Goodreads reviews, it's like either 5 or 1. It's just like people love it or absolutely hate it. But I mean, like that polarizing nature is also something that I appreciate, because it's like someone told me, it was Josh Moore, and he might have been paraphrasing someone else, but he said, you know, no one recommends like an okay book to someone. They only recommend like a great book. You're not going to be like,
yeah,
hey, why don't you check out this book? I just finished it. It's like, it was fine. But if you read something and you have an experience with that book, even if it is, you know, a negative experience, something that gets you like thinking, then I feel like there's more of a willingness to like talk about it.
Mm-hmm. And not only have you started these new classics, which is interesting, as you know, we talk a lot about reprinting in that way. You've also, you know, started a brick and mortar headquarters, and you started a film production side of things. So how have you seen yourself grow since the beginning in this way?
Well, I don't know. It's tricky. I mean, because I don't know that all of those were like smart decisions.
Fair enough.
It's one of those.
You try things though. That's important.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that there's, you know, just a real like spirit of creative discovery that I am totally into. And I hope that I am not too much like a cat with yarn where I'm just like pursuing all these different interests. But the storefront in particular, I feel like, fills a specific need where we, at the time, like, people would reach out to us and they're like, I'm passing through your town, like, where should I read at? And there just weren't that many options at the time. Mm-hmm. And so we had been talking about opening this space that could be a gathering space around literary culture in our town for, we've been talking about it for like a year or two, and then Trump got elected president. And it was like, okay, either the knee-jerk reaction was leave the country or finally open this. And it's like, if we're going to do it, we're going to do it now. Mm-hmm. So I think there was a pivot in the mindset, in the approach to having a bookstore, where it wasn't, it was kind of like trying to not reimagine, but sort of like, because I do think a lot of bookstores across the country are doing like really incredible work within their communities to be gathering spaces for their community, and that are expanding the idea of what a bookstore can be. Like, you're not just selling books. And so that was something that was important to us, to just like throw up a flag and say, like, not focus on the things that the president at the time was doing that were off-putting to us, but like create a space that people could gather around sort of the positive elements and say, like, this is what we're for. And it doesn't all just have to be specifically tied to a book. Mm-hmm. So we've hosted a lot of events with like the Columbus Education Justice Coalition, things around school, refugee and immigrant services, queer rights and activism. And that is as important to me as selling, you know, hot indie books. Mm. And it's a really fun and rewarding process too. I think in terms of publishing, you can sort of feel a little disconnected from the process, where at the time before we opened the store, I felt like we were throwing books out into the world, but not necessarily being a part of the conversation surrounding those sure. books. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to have that interaction with people where we could be in a space and physically talk about books, but not just our books, like literary culture in general.
Yeah, we got to go down to the store recently, and it was a really nice place. It had a great cafe, really open. Had a lot of $2 radio books, but other, you know, similarly interesting small press books around. It was just a really great space to be in.
I'm really sorry I missed you guys. That was a frantic weekend, but I appreciate you guys coming by.
We'll be back.
We will be back. Definitely. It's just all of our weekends are frantic. So
no,
we get down when we can. Understand.
If you ever want to do like an out of studio podcast thing or live podcast, that could be something fun to do too.
Yeah, that's a great idea. We've been trying to do like an Ohio book or a Midwest theme book or something like that.
Yeah,
live, so that could be really good.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious, if you guys were, you and your partner were naive and idealistic at the beginning, what would you say that you are now?
Battle hardened, disillusioned. No, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I think that I'm more entrenched in the realities of the situation now. Mm-hmm. And I'm feeling in a very realistic way, also beholden not to my, just myself and to Eliza, but also the people that we now have working for us. Like, we have to grow. We have to sell more books so that our staff can get paid more money. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like the cost of living has gone up every year. And last year was an awful year for book sales, 2023. Mm. But, you know, like, inflation's going up. And, you know, so it's like we have to make sure that we're meeting those demands of people so that we can all remain happy and functional and stuff like that in our positions. Mm-hmm. But I guess one thing that I really have a hard time like grappling with, and through the publishing company, we set up this, I guess we call it like a publishing mentorship program. So if anyone's like wants to start their own press, they can reach out and we can answer any questions about like, who do you print with? Who's your distributor? How do you approach a distributor? What are some ways you might be able to get funding? Because there is so much consolidation happening in publishing. And it, like, even a year from now, there's going to be more and more things that have happened that we won't have foreseen, not just with publishing companies, but with distributors. And that is kind of terrifying for me.
Yeah.
And another thing that I see a lot of is just lack of access to working and publishing jobs. And I feel like there is a lot. I mean, I've sat on panels with people where, you know, someone won't bat an eye by saying like they wanted to work in publishing. And so their dad bought them this huge company. And then they realized that they needed a backlist. And so their dad bought them a second publishing company. And it's just like there's those things. And then it's just like for us, it's just like, what planet are you on? Like, this is not normal at all. And then, you know, you look at some of the other publishing. So 2025 is technically going to be the 20th anniversary of $2 Radio. But you look at a lot of the other publishers that have started during that time, and they're, you know, heiresses to like conservative media empires, or the heir to a, you know, Belgian diamond mining company. So it's just like, though there is a need for there to be like a diversity of class too.
Yeah.
Between like who's working and publishing. So it's not just, I mean, I feel like we'll get a greater diversity of voices like through employing people from different backgrounds as well, not just the incestuous New York City publishing scene.
Oh boy. Yeah, that it very much is.
How do you guys enjoy being based in Cleveland? If I can ask you a question.
I love it. Yeah. I think Cleveland, I mean, I didn't know that much about Ohio or like the literary scene here prior to coming here, but there's great libraries, there's great bookstores. Like here we have Literary Cleveland, which offers like different free programs and readings and stuff. And I think it's a really surprisingly vibrant hub for like people who are interested in creative things and doing things more off the beaten track.
Yeah, we were in New York for a little bit last year. And, you know, the New York Public Library is this like awesome, amazing
institution.
Yeah. And then we got to Cleveland and was like, oh, the Cleveland Public Library is like 10 times better than the New York Public Library. It's crazy.
Yeah.
The books we have at the main branch are like, it's immense. The lists go back to so many great authors that are like either not being remembered or just finally getting republished, and all hundreds and hundreds of books that I would never find at any other library in the country. I think it's crazy.
We're so fortunate with the library system in Ohio.
Yeah.
In Cleveland, Columbus, and Cincinnati. Very fortunate.
Yeah.
It does seem like there's a lot of new stuff happening in Cleveland between the literary festivals and new bookstores opening and things like that. It's exciting.
For sure.
Yeah. There's still some tiny reasons to be idealistic.
We try to be.
Yeah.
Well, to wrap up the conversation, we wanted to say that as of recording today, it is June 17th, which happens to be the birthday of the great Barry Manilow. And given that, we would love to get him a $2 Radio book for his birthday. And we were wondering, what book would you recommend from your list that you would give to Barry Manilow?
Barry Manilow? Oh my goodness. I know who Barry Manilow is, but I'm not familiar with his oeuvre.
Neither am I.
I don't know. Does he have any creepy songs?
Maybe unintentionally.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Unintentionally creepy. I don't know. How about The Deeper the Water, the Uglier the Fish by Katya Apikinya?
Hell yeah.
Perfect.
Barry Manilow, come pick up your book here from us in Cleveland.
He's got to pick it up in person.
Yeah.
Yeah, and sing a song, and then he can have it.
That's fair. That's fair. I'd like to see that.
Be fantastic.
Yeah, that's our we're working on this concept, but that's our nod to the New York Times by the book column. What book would you recommend the president?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, I like that. It's out of left field. It was surprising for me. I would encourage you to continue doing it.
Thank you.
We will. We will. It's just you never know who you're going to get on that day.
I know.
Well, Thank you, Eric, so much for talking to us. Mm-hmm. It's been, I think you can go to a lot of different indie presses' website and kind of check out what their mission is, but there's no replacement for just hearing the story from somebody's lips.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I really appreciate it. It was great to talk to you guys, and I'm excited to hear your conversations with other presses soon.
Yeah, and we'll be back down soon. And go check it out if you can, if you're in the Ohio area.
That'd be great. I'd love to see you guys.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this interview. We have a couple more episodes of this variety lined up for the future. And please get in touch and let us know if there are any particular publishers that you would like to hear from.
See you in a week.